I'm David Hatch, host of Drinks with the Deal. And today our guests are Rick Rule, co-founder of the antitrust law firm Rule Garza Howley, and Dan Howley, a founding partner. Rick is a former chief of the DOJ Antitrust Division, who's been a partner at four of Washington's leading law firms, most recently Paul Weiss. In March, he launched Washington's newest antitrust boutique with two longtime colleagues, Deb Garza and Dan. Rick and Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks, David.
So today we're going to talk to Rick about his remarkable career, including his reflections on how the antitrust climate has changed in Washington, and to Dan about his decision to join Rule Garza. Rick, how did you get into antitrust, and what impact did attending the University of Chicago, legendary for its role in shaping competition law, have on your career?
Well, it's been a long time, so I have to think a little bit about that. But I think the bottom line is I liked to argue when I was a kid and was pretty good at it. And when I got out of Vanderbilt, the path of law seemed like to be the path that left the most options to me. I went to the University of Chicago because I was attracted to their law and economics policy, which more generally is what that law school is known for. When I got there, after my first year of law school, I got a job as one of the first research assistants at Lexicon, which was a startup law and economics consulting firm founded by Dick Posner, or former judge Richard Posner. And Posner was also one of the leading lights in terms of the revolution that was going on in antitrust. I went on to be Posner's research assistant. In my second year, Frank Easterbrook joined the faculty, now Judge Easterbrook. And I worked with Posner and Easterbrook on the second edition of Posner's case book. So I got into it with really two of the great names at the time in antitrust. And I was very much attracted by the so-called Chicago School. I had libertarian leanings. And the logic of the sort of consumer welfare standard, which was at the time sort of a novel concept, revolutionary, was very attractive to me. And it turned out that I think I had an aptitude for antitrust, and I found it fascinating because you're able to learn about individual industries sort of inside out to really do things well and understand how markets work. So I found that very fascinating. When I got out of law school, that was right when the Reagan administration was starting, and Bill Baxter, who was a fan of the Chicago School and a colleague of Posner and Easterbrook, hired me as a special assistant out of a clerkship. And that's kind of how I found my way to the antitrust division, and my career, in effect, took off from there.
Dan, how did you get started in the legal profession, and was there another path that you seriously consider?
So there was certainly another path. In college, I was a physics and electrical engineering major, which I actually found very interesting. And I thought very seriously in college about pursuing graduate school in physics. But the idea of spending my adult life in a lab was a little daunting. And I thought the law would be more fun. And so I applied to law school, and that's how I got into the field.
I should say Dan had sort of a litigation background and attracted him to our team. And he has been a core of our antitrust team for the last more than 10 years. But one of the things that I pride myself on, you can say a lot of things about me, but I think the one thing you can note is that I've been pretty good at selecting talent. Deb Garza, who is a classmate of mine, is somebody who I got into the antitrust division and saw a great deal of promise, and she ended up being a star. Tom Barnett was one of the first people that worked for Deb and me at Covington and Burling, and he went on to become the head of the antitrust division. Later, Jonathan Cantor and his now deputy, Andy Foreman, at the antitrust division were two young lawyers who we identified and brought into the team and who stayed with the team. But Dan and then Margo Campbell and Bill Dolan, the other founders of the firm, are really the stars of the next generation. And part of the reason that I did this is the fact that I could take folks like Dan, Margot, and Bill and help the rest of the world see what great stars they are, because I believe in them very intensely. And I do think that these folks are the next generation stars.
Rick, you were the youngest person to ever head the DOJ Antitrust Division. A three-part question. How old were you? What was it like to have that enormous responsibility at a young age? And does your record still stand?
Well, first, I became the acting head of the Antitrust Division in 1985 at the ripe old age of 29 years old, and was the acting head of the division for about half of that year. Doug Ginsburg then came in. I was his principal deputy when I was 30. And then Ginsburg went on to the Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit. And I took over as head of the division at the age of 31. You know, people ask me both at the time and now, wasn't it like super daunting? Wasn't it difficult to take on that responsibility? The answer is no, it really wasn't. I mean, at the time, it seemed kind of natural. I had spent my years from law school and after a clerkship until getting those positions in the division. And I had really become kind of a standard bearer for Chicago School and Consumer Welfare, was the one sort of consistent and constant Chicago school person in the division. And I had, I guess, a level of confidence given my strong belief in the logic of the consumer welfare standard. So, you know, maybe I should have been, and maybe it was just I was too young to know any better, but I was very confident that we were going in the right direction and that I could, with the help of other people at the division, get antitrust where it needed to go. As for the record standing, yes, and it probably won't be broken. I should add that Chair Kahn at the FTC is notable for her youth, but she is actually older than I was when I was the head of the division. But it certainly does give me a perspective on what she is up against. She probably has the same level of certitude I do, though going in the exact opposite direction. But my guess is that sort of confidence of youth gives her the fortitude to go through and make the decisions that aren't altogether popular out there in the broader world.
In the late 1990s, Rick, you were the lead lawyer for Exxon on its $80 billion mega merger with Mobil. You were able to secure clearance with minimal divestitures. Is that the type of consolidation that would be prohibited today?
I don't think so. And I actually think it's maybe worth talking a minute about that deal, because there are a lot of parallels between that deal and some of the deals today or some of the obstacles that folks will confront. First off, it was a deal that was marked by more political heat than real substantive concerns. There was this issue of putting back together the Standard Oil Trust that had been broken up 80 years before by the Supreme Court in a famous case. At the time, Bob Petoskey was the chairman of the Federal Trade Commission. And Petoskey, who had a great reputation as an antitrust academic, was a skeptic of the Chicago School and had greater affinity for some of the propositions and positions that the current administration is trying to move antitrust back to. So he, I think, began certainly as a skeptic to the deal. Moreover, and as he used to tell us in meetings when we were in his office, it was very troubling to him that a famous icon, trademark icon, the Red Pegasus of Mobil, would be put out of business. And that seemed to be very concerning to him. And as a result of that, the FTC essentially, I think, was determined to make it as difficult as it could for the parties to get through the transaction. At the same time, interestingly, in the arc of antitrust history, it was really one of the first deals that had to go through multiple clearances in foreign jurisdictions. It was one of the early cases that went to phase two at the EU. And so we helped to develop some of the processes there. But certainly that was the beginning of having to coordinate across a number of different jurisdictions simultaneously while the regulators were themselves coordinating. But the way we got through that deal and the way one can get through deals today is by understanding what the issues are that the agencies could address, making sure that you had the facts and evidence to support why those weren't problems and the logic of why they weren't problems, and then to just persist and to overcome all the obstacles. I can remember this was back in the day when you respond to second requests with actual documents. That doesn't happen anymore. Now everything is done through drives and that sort of thing. But we would every day have basically semi-trailers loaded with boxes that would be unloaded at the FTC. You go into the FTC and the boxes would be lined everywhere because they didn't have the room to hold them. And so it was very costly, very burdensome. But the key to winning it was to making it impossible for the FTC to say no. So every time they raised an issue or an obstacle, we were ready to deal with it. And then the final sort of parallel that is relevant as I think about it is the FTC, apropos of what the agencies are doing today, had just issued a study talking about the problems with remedies and sort of suggesting that the agencies should be more skeptical of remedies than maybe they had in the recent past. So we were dealing with an FTC at a time when there was a great deal of skepticism and where the word had gone out that we really aren't going to take remedies. Well, fact is that notwithstanding the rhetoric, if you present the agencies with a fix that solves a problem and takes an issue away from them in terms of litigating to block a deal, it's pretty hard for them to go in and block a deal. And we understood that, and we came up with remedies that, frankly, they couldn't refuse. And that, it was a long and a tough process. I think it developed a lot of the practices that are still in existence today, but also should give people hope, which has sort of been true throughout my 40 years of practice, that if you do your homework and you're persistent and open, credible, and you got the facts on your side, at the end of the day, you can prevail.
A question for both of you. It's been 2 months since the launch of Rule Garza. How's it going?
I think it's going very well. We are today somewhat unique. The last real sort of U.S. antitrust boutique that formed was Steve Axon's firm, but that's been over 20 years now. Generally, because of the changes that were brought about in the 80s, antitrust became more focused and it became, frankly, more suitable for big law firms and ended up gravitating to a practice of big law firms. The antitrust boutiques either went out of business or had to expand what they did. Now there has really been a change, or at least there's an effort to change antitrust, to broaden it out, to make it more relevant in more aspects of life. You have this, what I like to call multidimensional aspect to major antitrust investigations, where you not only have to focus on the agency, but you also have to focus on the politics, you have to focus on the states, you have to focus on foreign jurisdictions, you have to focus on investors. And all of that requires putting together a team. And it's very rare that a single firm has all of the capabilities. A firm like ours, I believe there'll be a lot of demand for it because we're not encumbered by those conflicts of big firms. We're not encumbered by their model. We've got more experience than anybody out there in a big firm or a small firm. And we can bring that to bear with clients by helping them put teams together, helping their advisors. And I think the place where our story has resonated perhaps most is with other M&A lawyers, M&A bankers, and others who see us as sort of a specialized boutique that can come in and advise them, sometimes give them a second opinion, but help them put the teams together, help them develop the strategy that's necessary to deal with all of the different issues that are going to come up to get to a successful conclusion. And again, when you marry that with the vast experience that we've had in seeing a lot of different deals and dealing with a lot of different investigations and essentially mentoring the leaders of the various agencies, it really is, I think, a winning proposition. And the response we've gotten, not just in the press, but also in terms of talking to the various groups that we've been out talking to, has been very, very positive.
And I think one of the things that's exciting and liberating about operating in a small firm is the flexibility in terms of billing. So we've been able to be, I think, pretty creative with different arrangements that aren't necessarily hourly based. And just one example is, given we've done a lot of deals and antitrust investigations over the years, we have a good idea of what the costs of those matters typically are, and we're able to hunt down some savings for the client and share in those savings on the back end with the client. And that seems to be a message that is resonating with clients. They understand we're not a model that's highly leveraged with associates, but that we're selling the team's experience, relationships, and expertise.
Dan, why did you decide to take the risk of joining a startup firm? And what advice do you have for other lawyers who might want to follow your lead?
Well, it's the right time, I think, for an antitrust firm. The antitrust environment is frothy right now. There are a lot of new theories of liability and higher political visibility for antitrust than any time in recent years. So that's one point. I think the second point is it's the right people. So Rick and Deb and Margo and Bill are great to work with and super experienced. And then third, the business plan made sense. And I really believe in the promise of the firm. So those are the reasons to join. And advice for more junior lawyers, I think they should find something interesting. Antitrust is a fascinating area of the law. It's intellectually rigorous, and every day is different than the day before. So find something interesting and find folks you like to work with and just keep an eye out for opportunities.
Rick, you've known Deb Garza since you were classmates at the University of Chicago, and you worked with her at the antitrust division in two DC law firms. How important is it to have a trusted colleague like Deb as your business partner?
I think it's important to work with people that you like and you trust. But in Deb's case, I view myself as being enormously lucky to know her and to have been associated with her, because she really is a trailblazer. Not only has she had various important positions in the antitrust division, she was the chair of the Antitrust Modernization Commission in the aughts. She went on to be the head of the ABA antitrust section, and she has been a leader in the development of antitrust for 40 years. So she is truly a star and really a role model for women and minorities in the antitrust bar. And to be able to work with her and have her as a partner, I mean, I view that as just like a super home run, even if I'd never worked with her before. But the fact that we went to law school together and have known each other for all these years and our career has been so intertwined really is great. Because I do think that in undertaking an effort like this, having implicit trust in your partners, trusting in their judgment, trusting in their knowledge, trusting that they're going to be part of the team and everybody's going to work towards a common end and not go off in their individual directions is absolutely critical. Particularly when you're trying to put together what we're trying to put together, which is a novel firm designed to address growing but somewhat new demand out there in the marketplace.
Dan, I understand that you also overlapped with Jonathan Kanter, the new chief of the DOJ Antitrust Division, and Rick at two other firms. Tell us about that.
That's right, David. I worked with Jonathan and Rick since 2008 when I left my clerkship, and worked with Jonathan up until he left Paul Weiss in late 2020. One of the last matters I worked with Jonathan on at Paul Weiss was the Sabre Farelogix transaction, which was a really interesting deal that some folks may be familiar with. It was a relatively small deal, $360 million deal involving airline booking technologies. And I believe it may still be the last merger case that DOJ's antitrust division took to verdict. Fortunately, there we won at trial on multiple grounds, but there's a few interesting things about that case, at least to me. First is, even in the last administration, we were seeing some changes in the antitrust theories that were being litigated, including an increased focus on vertical deals, an increased focus on labor issues, and in the example of Sabre Farelogix, an increased focus on the acquisition of nascent competitors by established, some would say dominant, incumbents. But what we saw at the trial and in the trial court's decision there was that these kind of new antitrust theories can have a hard time when the authorities have to prove their case in court. The other interesting thing about that matter was, although we won at trial in the US, in the UK, it was a different story. The regulator there took a very expansive view of its own jurisdiction. Even though there were no sales by the target in the UK, they still took jurisdiction, and they ultimately ruled against the deal shortly after the decision from the federal court in Delaware came down against DOJ. And DOJ and the UK regulators were in constant communication on that matter. For example, the UK lawyers were sitting in the courtroom during trial alongside the DOJ, which, you know, is kind of interesting to see from the defense side, and I think raises some interesting questions about the degree of coordination between these agencies. For example, I think there's kind of a reflexive view in the bar that international coordination is always a good thing, but at least to me, it's not clear whether that's necessarily a good thing for a government to coordinate with other jurisdictions to stop mergers of American companies, even if those deals are ultimately ruled to not violate U.S. law.
Rick, your Washington career has entered its fifth decade. What stayed the same in the world of antitrust over those years, and what's changed the most?
Well, I think the thing that stayed the same is the constancy of the federal antitrust statutes. The Sherman Act's been around since 1890, the Clayton Act and the FTC Act since 1914, with an important amendment to Section 7 in 1950. But that's a long time. And it is, I think, still the best antitrust regime because it's based on the rule of law, and it doesn't give the agencies power to make decisions. Instead, they have to go into court and persuade a judge, or in the case of a criminal violation, a jury, that there is a violation of the law. And I think that sort of constancy, that dependence on the rule of law, has been very beneficial. I think it's why the consumer welfare standard works, because it provides a kind of transparent, predictable method of decision that courts have found attractive. Now, the current administration is trying to change that, trying to expand the scope of the antitrust laws, interject it into other areas. But the fact is, the base of antitrust has stayed the same and still provides kind of a guiding light for deals and for lawyers and for business people. On the other hand, as I think back over the last 40 plus years, a lot has changed. When I left the antitrust division, the United States was really the only jurisdiction that had a merger control regulation. When I was in the government, our principal fights with other countries on antitrust issues were to beat back efforts to try to undermine and block antitrust enforcement. In the intervening 40 years, the foreign jurisdictions have become, if anything, more aggressive in terms of antitrust enforcement and more fervent in their adherence to antitrust. And you've seen a proliferation of jurisdictions. And today, the Europeans are arguably at least co-equals with the United States, and some might say even more important than the United States in merger deals. And certainly in 1989, when I left the division, I would have never predicted that probably the third most significant merger control regime would be in the People's Republic of China, and then all of those that have developed in between. And at the same time, and this was another thing that in my career I sort of started, was the role that the media plays and politics plays in antitrust. The Microsoft case, which I was involved for Microsoft and ultimately led the team that settled it, that was kind of the first case where every day of that trial, the press would be out there, and they were sort of competing with the Monica Lewinsky trial. People may remember that at the time for attention, but at every break you'd go out, and I was the spokesperson for Microsoft. And there was a lot of emphasis in terms of dealing with the media. And one can argue that David Boies's success, I mean, David was a very successful lawyer before that, but the Microsoft case definitely added to that. But a lot of his success was his ability to charm the press and get good press every day out of that trial. But that now, the kind of press element, the fact that folks like you, David, are involved in this and follow it, is another recent development. And it's something that people have to pay attention to. So the changes really in antitrust are that it's become far more multidimensional. And it's, I think, put a strain on lawyers who just have a very narrow, myopic focus on antitrust. And even though there is that rule of law, if you ignore those other constituencies, those other dimensions that really matter, you're going to be doing a disservice to your client, and really is the new reality that you have to recognize if you're going to be successful in advising firms.
This is a particularly tough climate in Washington for deal makers. What are some strategies companies should be thinking about to avoid merger litigation?
Yeah, let me start by saying, while it's multidimensional, as I said before, it's not rocket science. But I have a feeling that rocket scientists aren't advising companies. But the way you start out is you've got to put your mind in the minds of the regulators, and you've got to understand the level of creativity, which is unparalleled in the last 40 years. And there are a lot of theories, a lot of market focuses that really are novel, although they have some predecessors if you go back to the 60s and 70s. You've got to be able to understand that. You've got to be able to identify those things for clients. And then once you identify what the range of potential issues that could be raised, and I worry that a lot of people are so focused in on consumer welfare that they miss a lot of the things that can be problems for today's regulators. You have to see if the facts and logic will support defenses and counters to those concerns that would be raised. And you need to take time to develop those. And then you need to go into the process with confidence of your position. If you don't think that you have answers to the questions that are going to be posed, the fact is that's when you probably ought to reconsider your transaction. But if you've got answers, and if they're credible, and if you think at the end of the day they will prevail, then you go into the agencies from a position of strength and essentially don't feel like you're on the back foot, and tell them that, look, if you disagree with us, we'll eventually go to court. And so that kind of brings me to the last point about the strategy. The best way to stay out of court is to be prepared to go to court and to make it clear to the agencies that if they disagree and if they try to stop the merger, you are willing to go into court and that you have a strategy that is a winning strategy. It's sort of the antitrust equivalent of peace through strength. The best way to deter aggression is to be prepared and make it very clear that you can deal with that aggression. And I think sometimes companies think, well, let's throw a deal up, see how they react. We'll be very reactive. And if at the end of the day, we can't get it done, well, I guess we can't get it done. That's just not the right way to do it. You need to have a plan. You need to go into the plan, but you also need to reflect a strength of conviction that you are in the right, and that if you have to, you'll go to court and you'll tell an independent third party, i.e. a judge, your story, and you're confident that the judge will agree with you and not with the government.
I agree with all of that, including the it's critical to get ahead on the antitrust theories and, you know, show them you're willing to fight for your deal. The other thing I'd just add on is merger agreement provisions are more critical now than ever in terms of the antitrust risk sharing. There's new policies at the agencies about prior approval requirements, close at your peril letters, things like that that you need to think through when you're signing up a deal. Risk sharing arrangements and drop dead dates are becoming even more important than they usually are, even for deals that aren't necessarily problematic, especially if you're not looking under the new antitrust theories that are being considered these days. And the best way to address those negotiating points is to have a realistic and sober view of the antitrust risks when you're getting into it.
Rick and Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, David.
Thanks again to both of you for Drinks with the Deal. I'm David Hatch.